Macmillan Audio presents The Women, written by Kristen Hanna. Read for you by Julia Whalen, with a special appearance by Kristen Hanna.
This novel is dedicated to the courageous women who served in Vietnam. These women, most of them nurses and many of them raised on proudly told family stories of World War II heroism, heeded their country's call to arms and went to war. In too many instances, they came home to a country that didn't care about their service and a world that didn't want to hear about their experiences. Their post-war struggles and their stories were too often forgotten or marginalized. I am proud to have this opportunity to shine a light on their strength, resilience, and grit. And to all veterans and prisoners of war, missing in action, and their families who have sacrificed so much, and finally to the medical personnel who fought the pandemic and gave so much of themselves to help others, thank you.
Part 1. This war has stretched the generation gap so wide that it threatens to pull the country apart. Frank Church. 1. Coronado Island, California, May 1966. The walled and gated McGrath Estate was a world unto itself, protected and private. On this twilight evening, the Tudor-style home's mullioned windows glowed jewel-like amid the lush, landscaped grounds. Palm fronds swayed overhead, candles floated on the surface of the pool, and golden lanterns hung from the branches of a large California live oak. Black-clad servers moved among the well-dressed crowd, carrying silver trays full of champagne, while a jazz trio played softly in the corner. 20-year-old Frances Grace McGrath knew what was expected of her tonight. She was to be the very portrait of a well-bred young lady, smiling and serene. Any untoward emotions were to be contained and concealed, born in silence. The lessons Frankie had been taught at home and at church and at St. Bernadette's Academy for Girls had instilled in her a rigorous sense of propriety. The unrest going on across the country these days, erupting on city streets and college campuses, was a distant and alien world to her, as incomprehensible as the conflict in faraway Vietnam. She circulated among the guests, sipping an ice-cold Coca-Cola, trying to smile, stopping now and then to make small talk with her parents' friends, hoping her worry didn't show. All the while, her gaze searched the crowd for her brother, who was late to his own party. Frankie idolized her older brother, Finley. They'd always been inseparable, a pair of black-haired, blue-eyed kids less than 2 years apart in age who'd spent the long California summers unsupervised by adults, riding their bikes from one end of sleepy Coronado Island to the other, rarely coming home before nightfall. But now, he was going where she couldn't follow. The roar of a car engine disturbed the quiet party. Car horns honked loudly, in succession. Frankie saw how her mother flinched at the noise. Bette McGrath hated anything showy or vulgar, and she certainly didn't believe in announcing one's presence by honking a horn. Moments later, Finley banged through the back gate, his handsome face flushed, a lock of curly black hair fallen across his forehead. His best friend, Rye Walsh, had an arm around him, but neither looked too steady on his feet. They laughed drunkenly, held each other up, as more of their friends stumbled into the party behind them. Dressed impeccably in a black sheath, with her hair in a regal updo, Mom moved toward the group of laughing young men and women. She wore the pearls her grandmother had bequeathed her, a subtle reminder that Bette McGrath had once been Bette Alexander of the Newport Beach Alexanders.
Boys, she said in her modulated charm school voice, how nice that you are finally here. Finley stumbled away from Rye, tried to straighten. Dad motioned to the band, and the music stopped. Suddenly, the sounds of Coronado Island on a late spring night, the throaty purr of the ocean, the whisper of the palm fronds overhead, a dog barking down the street or on the beach took over. Dad strode forward in his custom-made black suit, crisp white shirt and black tie, holding a cigarette in one hand and a Manhattan in his other. With his close-cropped black hair and square jaw, he looked a little like an ex-boxer who'd hit the big time and learned how to dress well, which wasn't too far off. Even among this handsome, well-dressed crowd, he and Mom stood out, radiated success. She was old money and had always been at the top of the social ladder. He had climbed his way up to stand confidently beside her.
Friends, family, recent Academy graduates, Dad said in his booming voice.
When Frankie was young, he'd still had a hint of an Irish accent, which he'd worked hard to eliminate. He often touted his own immigrant mythology, a story of bootstrapping and hard work. He rarely mentioned the good fortune and opportunity that had come with marrying the boss's daughter, but everyone knew. They also knew that after the death of Mom's parents, Dad had more than tripled their wealth with his zeal for developing California real estate. He put an arm around his slender wife, drew her as close as she would allow in public.
"We're grateful that you have come to help us say bon voyage to our son, Finley."
Dad smiled.
"No more bailing him out of the Coronado police station at 2 a.m. after some ridiculous drag race."
There was a smattering of laughter. Everyone at this party knew the circuitous track Finley had taken to adulthood. From earliest memory, he had been a golden boy, a wild child who could make the hardest heart soften. People laughed at his jokes. Girls followed him everywhere. Everyone loved Finley, but most agreed that he was a handful. He had been held back in fourth grade, more for constant mischievousness than anything else. He was sometimes disrespectful in church, and he liked the kind of girl who wore short skirts and carried cigarettes in her purse. When the laughter ended, Dad went on.
"A toast to Finley and his grand adventure. We are proud of you, son."
Servers appeared with bottles of Dom Perignon and poured more champagne. The tinkling sound of glass on glass filled the air. Guests surrounded Finley. Men clapped him on the back in congratulations. Young women pressed forward, vying for his attention. Dad motioned to the band, and music started up again. Feeling left out, Frankie headed into the house, past the large kitchen where the caterers were busily putting canapés on trays. She ducked into her father's office. It had been her favorite place as a child. Big tufted leather chairs, footstools, two walls of books, a massive desk. She flicked on the light. The room smelled of old leather and cigars, with a hint of expensive aftershave. Neatly organized stacks of building permits and architectural plans lay atop the desk. One entire wall of the office was devoted to their family history. Framed photographs Mom had inherited from her parents, and even a few Dad had brought with him from Ireland. There was a photo of great-grandfather McGrath in his soldier's uniform saluting the camera. Alongside that photograph was a framed war medal that her grandpa Francis had been awarded in the First World War. The photograph of her parents' wedding was positioned between her grandfather Alexander's framed purple heart and a newspaper clipping with a photo of the ship he'd served on coming into harbor at the end of the war. There were no photographs of her father in uniform. To his great shame, he had been labeled 4F and disqualified for military service. It was something he lamented in private, only to family, and only when he'd been drinking. After the war, he'd convinced Grandpa Alexander to begin building affordable housing in San Diego for returning veterans. Dad called it his contribution to the war effort, and it had been spectacularly successful. In conversation, he was always so military proud that in time, everyone on Coronado seemed to forget he hadn't served. There were no photographs of his children, not yet. Her father believed that one had to earn their way onto this wall. Frankie heard the door open quietly behind her, and someone said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I don't mean to intrude." She turned and saw Rye Walsh standing in the doorway. He held a cocktail in one hand and a pack of old gold cigarettes in the other. No doubt he'd been looking for a quiet place to smoke. "I'm hiding from the party," she said. "I don't feel much like celebrating, it seems." He left the door open behind him.
"I was doing the same thing, I guess. You probably don't remember me."
"Joseph Ryerson Walsh. Goes by Rye, like the whiskey," Frankie said, trying to smile. It was how he'd introduced himself to her last summer. "Why are you hiding out? You and Finn are thick as thieves. You both love a good party." As he neared, her heart did a queer little stutter. He'd had that effect on her from their first meeting, but they'd never really spoken. She didn't know what to say to him now, when she felt a little bereft, lonely.
"I'm going to miss him," he said quietly.
She felt the sting of tears and turned quickly away, faced the wall of memorabilia. He moved in beside her. They stared up at the family photos and mementos, men in uniforms, women in wedding dresses, medals for valor and injury, a triangle folded and framed American flag that had been given to her paternal grandmother.
"How come there are no pictures of women up here, except for the wedding pictures?"
Rye asked. "It's a hero's wall, to honor the sacrifices our family has made in service of the country." He lit a cigarette.
"Women can be heroes."
Frankie laughed.
"What's funny about that?"
She turned to him, wiped the tears from her eyes. Well, you don't mean...
"Yeah,"
he said, looking down at her. She couldn't remember a man ever looking at her in such a way, so intensely. It made her catch her breath.
"I mean it, Frankie. It's 1966. The whole world is changing."
Hours later, when the guests had begun to make their polite exits, Frankie found herself still thinking about Rye and what he'd said. Women can be heroes. No one had ever said such a thing to her. Not her teachers at St. Bernadette's, not her parents, not even Finley. Why had it never occurred to Frankie that a girl, a woman, could have a place on her father's office wall for doing something heroic or important, that a woman could invent something or discover something or be a nurse on the battlefield, could literally save lives? The idea of it was like an earthquake, an upending of her sheltered view of the world, of herself. She'd been told for years, by the nuns, by her teachers, by her mother, that nursing was an excellent profession for a woman. Teacher, nurse, secretary. These were acceptable futures for a girl like her. Only last week, her mother had listened to Frankie talk about her struggles in upper-level biology and said gently, "Who cares about frogs, Frances? You're only going to be a nurse until you get married. And by the way, it's time you start thinking about that. Quit rushing through your classes and slow down. Who cares if you graduate early? You need to date more." Frankie had been taught to believe that her job was to be a good housewife, to raise well-mannered children and keep a lovely home. In her Catholic high school, they'd spent days learning how to iron buttonholes to perfection, how to precisely fold a napkin, how to set an elegant table. At the San Diego College for Women, there wasn't much rebellion among her classmates and friends. Girls laughed about working for their MRS degree. Even her own choice of nursing as a degree hadn't required much introspection. All she'd really focused on was getting good grades and making her parents proud. As the musicians packed up their instruments and the waiters began clearing away the empty glasses, Frankie flipped off her sandals and left the yard and wandered across empty Ocean Boulevard, the wide, paved street that separated her parents' house from the beach. The golden sand of Coronado Beach stretched out in front of her. Off to the left was the famous Hotel del Coronado, and to the right was the large Naval Air Station North Island, which had recently been recognized as the birthplace of naval aviation. A cool night breeze plucked at her bouffant chin-length bob. but it was no match for the layer of aquanet that kept every strand in place. She sat down in the cool sand, looped her arms around her bent knees, and stared out at the waves. A full moon hung overhead. Not far away, a beach bonfire glowed orange. The smell of smoke drifted on the night air. How did a woman go about opening up her world? How did one begin a journey when no invitation had been issued? It was easy for Finley. The path had been laid out for him. He was to do what all the McGrath and Alexander men did, serve his country with honor and then take over the family real estate business. No one had ever suggested any future for Frankie beyond marriage and motherhood. She heard laughter behind her, the sound of running feet. A young blonde woman took off her shoes at the water's edge and splashed into the surf. Rye followed her, laughing, not even bothering to take off his shoes. Someone sang "Walk Like a Man" off key. Finley plopped down beside Frankie, fell drunkenly into her.
"Where have you been all night, doll? I missed you."
"Hey, Finn," she said quietly. Leaning into him, she remembered their lives on this beach. As children, they'd built elaborate sandcastles and bought creamsicles from the jangling ice cream truck that drove up and down Ocean Boulevard in the summer. They'd spent long hours on their surfboards, feet dangling over the sides, talking beneath the hot sun as they waited for the right wave, sharing their deepest secrets. Together, always. Best friends. She knew what he needed from her now. She should tell Finn she was proud of him and send him off with a smile, but she couldn't do it. They'd never lied to each other. It didn't seem like the time to start. "Finn, are you sure you should go to Vietnam?"
"Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country."
Frankie sighed. She and Finley had idolized President Kennedy. His words meant something to them, so how could she argue?
"I know, but..."
"It isn't dangerous, Frankie. Trust me, I'm a Naval Academy graduate, an officer with a cushy assignment on a ship. I'll be back in no time. You'll hardly have time to miss me."
Everyone said the same thing. Communism was an evil that had to be stopped. These were the Cold War years, dangerous times. If a great man like President Kennedy could be shot in broad daylight by a Red in Dallas, how could any American feel safe? Everyone agreed that communism couldn't be allowed to flourish in Asia, and Vietnam was the place to stop it. The nightly news showed smiling soldiers marching in packs through the Vietnamese jungle and giving newsmen the thumbs up. No bloodshed. Finley put an arm around her.
"I'll miss you, Peanut," he said.
She heard the catch in his voice and knew he was scared to go. Had he been hiding it from her all along, or hiding it from himself? And there it was. The fear and worry she'd been trying to suppress all night, to ignore. Suddenly, it was too big to bear. No looking away now. Her brother was going to war. 2. For the next 6 months, Frankie wrote to her brother every Sunday after church. In return, she received funny letters about his life on board the ship and the antics of his fellow sailors. He sent postcard pictures of lush green jungles and aqua seas and beaches with sand the color of salt. He told her about parties at the O Club and rooftop bars in Saigon and celebrities who came to entertain the troops. In his absence, Frankie increased her course load and graduated early, with honors. As a newly registered nurse, she landed her first ever job, working the night shift at a small hospital in nearby San Diego. She had recently begun to think about moving out of her parents' home and getting an apartment of her own, a dream she'd shared with Finley in a letter only last week. "Think of it, Finn. Us living in a little place near the beach, maybe in Santa Monica. What fun we could have." Now, on this cool night in the last week of November, the corridors of the hospital were quiet. Dressed in her starched white uniform, with a nurse cap pinned on her sprayed bouffant bob, Frankie walked behind the night charge nurse, who led the way into a private room devoid of flowers or visitors, where a young woman lay sleeping. Frankie was being told, yet again, how to do her job. "High school girl from St. Anne's," the night charge nurse said, then mouthed, "baby," as if the word itself were a sin. Frankie knew that St. Anne's was the local home for unwed mothers, but it was a thing no one ever talked about. The girls who left school suddenly and came back months later, quieter and lonely-looking.
"Her IV is low. I could..." "For goodness sake, Miss McGrath, you know you're not ready for that. How long have you been here, a week?"
"2, ma'am. And I'm a registered nurse. My grades don't matter. It's clinical skills I care about, and you have little of those. You are to check bedpans, refill water pitchers, help patients to the toilet. When you're ready to do more, I'll let you know."
Frankie sighed quietly. She hadn't put in all those long, exhausting hours in study carrels, getting her nursing degree early so that she could change bedpans and fluff pillows. How was she going to acquire the clinical skills she needed to land a job at a first-rate hospital?
"So, please record and monitor all IV meds. I'll need the information promptly. Go."
Frankie nodded and began her nightly rounds, going from room to room. It was almost 3 in the morning when she came to room 107. She opened the door gently, hating to waken the patient if she could help it.
"Have you come to see the freak show?"
Frankie paused, uncertain of what to do.
"I could come back."
"Stay, please."
Frankie closed the door behind her and moved toward the bed. The patient was a young man with long, shaggy blonde hair and a pale, narrow face. A weedy patch of blonde and brown hair tufted above his upper lip. He looked like a kid you'd find surfing the break at Trestles, except for the wheelchair in the corner. She could see the outline of his legs, or his one leg, beneath the white blanket.
"You can look," he said. "It's impossible not to. Who wouldn't look at a car wreck?"
"I'm bothering you," she said, taking a step back, starting to turn.
"Don't go. They're sending me to a psych ward for trying to kill myself. Involuntary hold or some bullshit. Like they would know what I was thinking. Anyway, you might be the last sane person I see for a while."
Frankie moved forward cautiously, checked his IV, made a notation on his chart.
"I should have used my gun," he said.
Frankie didn't know how to respond. She had never met anyone who had tried to commit suicide. It seemed impolite to ask why, but equally impolite to remain silent.
"I made it 340 days in country. Thought I was home free. That ain't good, being a short-timer."
At Frankie's obvious confusion, he said,
"Vietnam."
He sighed.
"My girl, Jilly, she hung with me, wrote me love letters right up until I stepped on that damn bouncing Betty and lost a leg."
He looked down.
"She told me I'd adjust and to give it time. I'm trying."
"Your girl told you that?"
"Hardly. A nurse at the 12th Evac Hospital. She got me through, man. Sat with me while I lost my shit."
He looked at Frankie, reached out for her hand.
"Will you stay till I fall asleep, ma'am? I have these nightmares."
"Sure, soldier. I won't go anywhere."
Frankie was still holding his hand when he fell asleep. She couldn't help thinking of Finley and the letters he wrote to her each week, full of funny stories and the beauty of the countryside.
"You should see the silk and gems over here, doll. Mom would never stop shopping. And boy, do sailors know how to party."
He told her repeatedly that the war was coming to an end. Walter Cronkite said the same thing on the nightly news. But it was still going on. And men were dying. Losing their legs, apparently. "A nurse at the 12th Evac Hospital. She got me through, man." Frankie had never thought about nurses in Vietnam. The newspapers never mentioned any women. Certainly no one talked about any women at war. Women can be heroes. At that, Frankie felt a kind of reawakening, the emergence of a bold new ambition.
"I could serve my country,"
she said to the man whose hand she held. It was a revolutionary, frightening, exhilarating thought. But could she? Really? How did you know if you had the strength and courage for a thing like that? Especially as a woman, raised to be a lady whose courage had been untested. She let the idea soar, closed her eyes, imagined telling her parents that she'd joined the Navy and would be going to Vietnam, writing a letter to Finley. Drumroll, please. I've joined the Navy and will be shipping out to Vietnam. See you soon. If she did it now, they could be over there together, in country. She could earn her place on the hero's wall, and not for marrying well, for saving lives in wartime. Her parents would be so proud of her, as proud as they'd been of Finley. All her life she'd been taught that military service was a family duty. Wait, think about it, Frankie. It could be dangerous. But the danger didn't resonate. She'd be on a hospital ship, far from the fighting. By the time she let go of the soldier's hand, she had decided. In the past week, Frankie had planned her day off obsessively, saying nothing to anyone about her intentions, seeking no counsel. She'd repeatedly told herself to slow down, think it through, and she'd tried to do it, but the truth was that she knew what she wanted to do, and she didn't want anyone to dissuade her. After a quick shower, she returned to her bedroom, which had been designed for a young girl years ago, with its frilly canopy bed and shag rug and striped cabbage rose print wallpaper. She chose one of the conservative dresses her mother so often purchased for her. Quality pieces, Frances. That's how a woman distinguishes herself at first glance. As expected, this time of day the house was empty. Mom was playing bridge at the country club, and Dad was at work. At 1:25, Frankie drove to the nearest Navy recruitment office, where a small clot of war protesters stood outside, yelling slogans and holding up signs that read, "War is not healthy for children and other living things," and "Bombing for peace is like screwing for virginity." Two men with long hair were burning their draft cards, which was illegal, while the crowd cheered them on. Frankie had never understood these protests. Did they really think that a few posters would convince LBJ to stop the war? Did they not understand that if Vietnam fell to communism, so would all of Southeast Asia? Did they not read about how vicious such regimes could be? Frankie felt acutely conspicuous as she got out of her car. She clutched her expensive navy calfskin purse close to her side as she approached the crowd, who chanted, "Hell no, we won't go!" The crowd turned toward her, stilled for a moment. "It's a damn young Republican!" someone shouted. Frankie forced herself to keep walking. "Oh, man," someone else said. "This chick is crazy! Don't go in there, man!" Frankie opened the recruiting station's doors. Inside, she saw a desk beneath a sign that read, "Be a Patriot, Join the Navy." A sailor in uniform stood at the end of the table. Frankie closed the door behind her and went to the recruiting desk. Protesters banged on the window. Frankie tried not to flinch or appear nervous or afraid. "I'm a nurse," she said, ignoring the sounds coming from outside. "I'd like to join the Navy and volunteer for Vietnam." The sailor glanced nervously at the crowd outside.
"How old are you?"
20, sir. 21 next week.
"The Navy requires 2 years of service before they send you to Vietnam, ma'am. You'll need to do 2 years stateside in a hospital before you ship out."
2 years? The war would be over by then.
"You don't need nurses in Vietnam?"
"Oh, we need them."
"My brother is in Vietnam. I want to help."
"I'm sorry, ma'am. Rules are rules. It's for your own safety, believe me."
Dispirited but not discouraged, Frankie left the recruiting office, hurried past the protesters who yelled obscenities at her, and found a nearby phone booth, where she consulted the Los Angeles Yellow Pages and found the address for the nearest Air Force recruiting station. Once there, she was told the same thing, that she needed more stateside experience before shipping out to Vietnam.
At the Army recruiting station, she finally heard what she wanted to hear. "Sure, ma'am. The Army Nurse Corps needs nurses. We could ship you right out after basic." Frankie signed her name on the dotted line, and just like that, she was Second Lieutenant Frances McGrath. 3. By the time Frankie got back on island, the street lamps were coming on. Downtown Coronado was dressed for the holidays, with streamers and lights. White, bearded, red-coated Santas stood in front of several shops ringing bells. Illuminated snowflakes hung from lines strung above the street. At home, Frankie found her parents in the living room, dressed for dinner. Dad stood at the bar, flipping through the newspaper, while Mom sat in her favorite chair by the fire, smoking a cigarette and reading a Graham Greene novel. The house was decked out for the holidays, with an extravagance of lights and a 10-foot tree. At Frankie's entrance, Dad closed the newspaper and smiled at her.
"Hey, you peanut."
"I have news," Frankie said, practically bursting with excitement.
"You've met a boy you like," Mom said, putting down her novel.
"Finally." Frankie came to a stop. "A boy? No." Mom frowned.
"Frances, most of the girls your age."
"Mom," Frankie said impatiently, "I'm trying to tell you something important." She took a deep breath and said, "I joined the Army Nurse Corps, the ANC. I'm now Second Lieutenant McGrath. I'm going to Vietnam. I'll get to be with Finley for part of his tour."
"That's hardly funny, Frances," Mom said.
Dad stared at Frankie, unsmiling.
"I don't think she's joking, Bet."
"You joined the Army?"
Mom said slowly, as if the words were a foreign language that she was trying to sound out.
"I'd salute, but I don't know how. Basic training starts in 3 weeks. Fort Sam Houston."
Frankie frowned. Why weren't they congratulating her?
"McGraths and Alexanders always serve," she said. "You were thrilled when Finley volunteered."
"The men serve,"
Dad said sharply.
"The men."
He paused.
"Wait, did you say the Army? We're a Navy family, always have been. Coronado is a Navy island."
"I know, but the Navy wouldn't let me go to Vietnam until I'd served 2 years in a hospital stateside," she said. "Same with the Air Force. They said I didn't have enough experience. Only the Army would let me go right after basic training."
"Sweet Jesus, Frankie,"
Dad said, running a hand through his hair.
"There's a reason for rules like that."
"Take it back. Unvolunteer."
Mom looked at Dad. She got to her feet slowly.
"Good Lord, what will we tell people?" "What will you..."
Frankie didn't understand. They were acting as if they were ashamed of her. But that made no sense.
"How many times have you gathered us in your office to talk about this family's record of service, Dad? You told us how much you wanted to fight for your country. I thought..."
"He's a man," Mom said. "And it was Hitler and Europe, not some country no one can find on a map. It is not patriotic to do something stupid, Frances."
Tears filled her eyes. She dashed them away impatiently.
"Well, Connor, she's what you taught her to be, a believer, a patriot."
At Mom's rebuke, Dad left the room, trailing smoke behind him. Frankie went to her mom, tried to hold her hand, but Mom stepped adroitly aside, not letting Frankie touch her.
"Mom?"
"I shouldn't have let your father fill your head with all that history. He made it sound so epic, those family war stories. Although none of them were his, were they? He couldn't serve, so it became... Oh, for God's sake, none of it matters now."
She looked away.
"I remember when my father came home from the war, broken, stitches holding him together. He had nightmares. I swear it's what killed him early."
Her voice broke.
"And you think you'll go over there and see your brother and have an adventure? How could you be so stupid?"
"I'm a nurse, Mom, not a soldier. The recruiter said I'll be stationed at a big hospital far from the front. He promised I would get to see Finley."
"And you believed him?"
Mom took a long drag off of her cigarette. Frankie saw how her hand was shaking.
It's done?
It's done. I report to basic training in January, and then I ship out for my tour in March. I'll be home for my birthday next week, and for Christmas. I made sure. I know how much that matters to you.
Mom bit her lip, nodding slowly. Frankie could see that her mother was trying to corral her emotions, trying to look calm. Suddenly, she reached out, pulled Frankie into her arms, hugged her so tightly she couldn't breathe. Frankie clung to her, buried her face in the teased, sprayed hair.
I love you, Mom, she said.
Mom drew back, wiped her eyes, and looked hard at Frankie. Don't you be a hero, Frances Grace. I don't care what you've been taught or what stories men like your father have told you. You keep your head down and stay back and stay safe. You hear me?
I promise. I'll be fine.
The doorbell rang. It was a distant sound, barely audible above the combination of their breathing and the unspoken words swirling in the silence between them. Mom glanced sideways toward the foyer.
Who on earth could that be?
I'll go, Frankie said.
She left her mother standing in the living room, alone. In the foyer, Frankie stepped around the gleaming rosewood table that held a large potted white orchid and opened the door. Two naval officers in dress uniforms stood there at attention. Frankie had lived on Coronado Island all of her life, watched jets and helicopters roar overhead and sailors run in lines along the beach. At every party or gathering, someone told a World War II or Korea story. The town cemetery was full of men Coronado had lost in wars. She knew what officers at the front door meant.
Please,
she whispered, wanting to back up and close the door. She heard footsteps behind her, heels on hardwood. Frances, Mom said, coming up beside her.
What?
Mom saw the two officers and let out a quiet gasp.
I'm sorry, ma'am,
one of the officers said, taking off his hat, tucking it under his arm. Frankie reached for her mother's hand, but Mom pulled away.
Come in,
Mom said in a husky voice.
You'll want to speak to my husband.
Sorry to inform you, ma'am, that Ensign Finley McGrath has been killed in action. Shot down, in a helicopter, no remains, all hands lost. No answers to their questions, just a quietly spoken, it's war, sir, as if that said it all. Answers are hard to come by. Frankie knew she would remember this evening in startling, scalding images. Dad, standing tall, his hands shaking, showing no emotion until one of the officers called his son a hero, his voice quiet as he asked for details as if they mattered. Where, when, how? Her mom, usually so elegant and cool, curling into herself on the chair, her carefully coiffed hair falling slowly apart, saying again and again, "How can it be? Connor, you said it was barely a war."
Frankie didn't think either of her parents noticed when she slipped out of the house and crossed Ocean Boulevard to sit in the cool sand. How had he been shot down? What was an officer's aide doing in a helicopter? And what did it mean that there were no remains? What were they supposed to bury? She felt tears well again and closed her eyes, recalled images of Finley on this beach, running into the surf, holding her hand, teaching her how to float on her back, how to swim, taking her to see Psycho when Mom had specifically forbidden it, sneaking her a bottle of beer on the 4th of July. She closed her eyes and let the memories flow. She remembered him and their life together, their fights and squabbles, going to Disneyland for the first time, riding their bikes in the summer and racing to the tree on Christmas morning, him letting her win. Her big brother. Gone. How often had she and Finn been out here at night together, running on the beach, riding their bikes home at night, guided by street lamps, laughing, poking each other, holding their arms outstretched and thinking that riding a bicycle without holding on was taking a risk. How free they had felt. Invincible.
She felt a presence on the beach behind her, heard footfalls. Mom sat down in the sand beside her, half falling the last few inches. "They say we should bury another man's boots and helmet in my son's casket," she said at last. Her lower lip was bleeding a little where she'd bitten it. She scratched at a red spot on her neck. "A funeral," Frankie said, thinking about it for the first time. Mourners in black, perched on pews, Father Michael droning on, telling funny stories about Finley, about his days as a rebellious altar boy, how he'd washed his toy soldiers in the baptismal font. How could any of them stand it? An empty coffin, no remains. "Don't go," Mom said quietly.
"I'm right here, Mom."
Mom turned. "I mean, to Vietnam." Vietnam. A car crash of a word now.
"I have to," Frankie said. It was all she'd thought about since learning about her brother's death. How to get out of her commitment to the army. How to stay here with her parents and grieve and be safe. But it was too late for that. She'd signed on, made a promise.
"I don't have a choice, Mom. I can't undo it."
She turned, said,
"Give me your blessing, please. I need you to say you're proud of me."
For a split second, Frankie saw her mother's pain. It pulled the life from her cheeks and the color from her skin. She was pale, washed out. She stared at Frankie, her blue eyes dull, lifeless.
"Proud of you?"
"You don't have to worry about me, Mom. I'll come home. I promise."
"Those were your brother's last words to me."
Mom's voice broke. She paused for a second, looked like she was going to speak. Instead, she got slowly to her feet, turned away from Frankie, and walked back across the sand.
"I'm sorry,"
Frankie whispered, too softly for her mother to hear, but what did it matter? It was too late for words. Too late to take any of it back. 4. Frankie excelled in basic training. Along with learning to march in formation, teamwork, and put on combat boots and a gas mask quickly, you never knew when you might be wakened at midnight for an emergency. You needed to move fast in a war zone. She'd learned how to apply a splint, debride a wound, carry a stretcher, and start an IV. She could roll bandages faster than any other recruit. By March, she was more than ready to put her new skills to the test. She had packed and checked her large army-issued duffel bag, which she'd crammed full with her flak jacket, steel pot helmet, combat boots, GI kit, white nursing uniform, and field jacket. And now, at last, she was on her way. Hours after landing in Honolulu, she boarded a jet bound for Vietnam, the lone woman at the front of a line of 257 uniformed soldiers. Unlike the men, dressed in their comfortable olive drab fatigues, neatly bloused inside black boots, Frankie was required to travel in her Class A uniform, a green jacket, slim skirt, nylons, polished black pumps, and flat garrison hat. And beneath all of that, a regulation panty girdle to keep her nylon stockings up. It had been uncomfortable when she'd left Texas and boarded the plane bound for Vietnam. Now, 22 hours later, it was downright painful. It seemed ridiculous to her that in this day and age, she couldn't wear pantyhose. She tucked her new, soft-sided overnight travel bag into the overhead bin and took a seat next to the window. As she sat down, a garter on her panty girdle snapped and popped her thigh like a rubber band. She struggled to get it fixed, sitting down. Soldiers filed past her, laughing and talking, shoving each other. Many of them looked to be her age or even younger, 18, 19 years old, most of them. A captain in stained, wrinkled fatigues paused at the end of her row.
"Mind if I join you, Lieutenant?"
"Of course, Captain."
He sat down in the aisle seat.
Even in fatigues, she could see how thin he was. Heavy lines creased his cheeks. His clothes had the vague, unpleasant odor of mildew.
"Norm Bronson," he said with a tired smile.
"Frankie, McGrath, nurse."
"Bless your heart, Frankie. We need nurses."
The plane rolled forward, lifted off from the runway, and rose into the clouds.
"What's it like?" she asked. "Vietnam, I mean."
"Words won't help, ma'am. I could talk all day about what it's like, and you still won't be ready. But you'll learn fast. Just keep your head down."
He leaned back and closed his eyes. Frankie had never seen anyone fall asleep so quickly. She reached into her black regulation handbag, pulled out her information packet, and reread it for the thousandth time. Repetition and knowledge had always calmed her, and she was determined to be as exemplary a soldier as she'd been a student. It was the only way to prove to her parents that she'd been smart to enlist, courageous even. Success mattered to them. She had memorized all of the military command and hospital locations, had underlined them in yellow on her map of Vietnam. She had also taken the behavioral guidelines to heart, rules for personal conduct, for security on base, for what to wear and how to deal with firearms, for always taking pride in being a soldier. Everything made sense to her in the Army. Rules existed for a reason, and you followed them to maintain order and help each other. The system was designed to force soldiers, men and women, into conformity, to build teams. It could save your life, apparently.
Fitting in, being part of something larger, knowing your job and doing it without question. She was comfortable with all of it.
As she told her mother repeatedly, she was going off to war, but not really, not like the men on this plane. She wouldn't be on the front lines, wouldn't get shot at. She was going to Vietnam to save men's lives, not to risk her own. Military nurses worked in big, bright buildings like the huge Third Field Hospital in Saigon, which was protected by high fencing and was far from the fighting. Frankie leaned back and closed her eyes, letting the rumble of the engines lull and calm her. She heard the buzz of men talking, laughing, the snap hiss of colas being opened, the smell of sandwiches being handed out. She imagined Finley on the plane with her, holding her hand. For a split second, she forgot that he was gone and she smiled. "Coming to meet you," she thought. And then her smile faded. As she drifted off to sleep, she thought she heard Captain Bronson mumble quietly,
"Sending goddamn babies."
When Frankie woke, the airplane cabin was quiet except for the hum of the jet engines. Most of the window shades were drawn. A few overhead lights cast a gloomy glow over the men packed into the jet. The loud razzing, the laughter, the horseplay that had marked most of this flight from Honolulu to Saigon was gone. The air seemed heavier, harder to draw into her lungs, harder to expel in an exhalation. The new recruits, recognizable by their still creased green fatigues, were restless, unsettled. Frankie saw the way they looked at each other, their smiles bright and brittle. The other soldiers, those weary-looking men in their worn fatigues, men like Captain Bronson, sat almost too still. Beside Frankie, the captain opened his eyes. It was the only change in him from sleeping to awake, just an opening of his eyes. Suddenly, the plane lurched, or bucked, seemed to turn onto its side. Frankie smacked her head on the tray on the back of the seat in front of her as the plane nosedived. The overhead bins opened. Dozens of bags fell out into the aisle, including Frankie's. Captain Bronson put his rough, gnarled hand on hers as she clutched the armrest.
"It'll be okay, Lieutenant."
The plane stalled, steadied, lurched upward into a steep climb. Frankie heard a pop and something cracked beside her.
"Is someone shooting at us?" Frankie said. "Oh my God!"
Captain Bronson chuckled.
"Yeah, they love to do that. Don't worry, we'll just circle around for a while and try again."
"Here? Shouldn't we go somewhere else to land?"
"In this big bird? Nope. It's Tonson Newt for us, ma'am. They'll be waiting on the FNGs we got on board.
FNGs?
Fucking new guys. He smiled. And one beautiful young nurse. Our boys will clear the airport in no time, not to fret.
The plane circled until Frankie's fingers ached from the pain of her grip on the armrests. Outside, she saw orange and red explosions and streaks of red across the dark sky. Finally, the plane evened out, and the pilot came on the loudspeaker to say,
"Okay, sports fans, let's try this shit again. Buckle up."
As if Frankie had ever unbuckled her seatbelt. The jet descended. Frankie's ears popped, and the next thing she knew, they were thumping onto the runway and powering down, rolling to a stop.
"Senior officers and women disembark first," sounded over the loudspeaker.
The officers waited for Frankie to exit first. She wished they hadn't. She didn't want to be first. Still, she grabbed her travel bag from the aisle and slung it, and her purse, over her left shoulder, leaving her right hand free to salute. When she exited the aircraft, heat enveloped her. And the smell. Good Lord, what was it? Jet fuel, smoke, fish, and honestly, there was a stench of something like excrement. A headache started to pulse behind her eyes. She made her way down the stairs, where a lone soldier stood in the darkness, backlit by ambient light from a distant building. She could barely make out his face. Off to the distant left, something exploded in orange flames.
"Lieutenant McGrath?"
She could only nod. Sweat crawled down her back. Were they bombing over there? The soldier said,
"Follow me,"
and led her across the bumpy, pockmarked runway, past the terminal, and to a school bus that had been painted black, even the windows, which were covered in some kind of chicken wire mesh.
"You're the only nurse arriving today. Take a seat and wait. Don't exit the bus, ma'am."
The heat in the bus was sauna-like, and that smell, shit and fish, made her gag. She took a seat in the middle row of seats by a black-painted window. It felt like being entombed. Moments later, a black soldier in fatigues carrying an M16 climbed into the driver's seat. The doors whooshed shut, and the headlights came on, carving a golden wedge out of the darkness ahead.
"Not too close to the window, ma'am,"
he said, and hit the gas.
"Grenades."
Grenades? Frankie inched sideways on the bench seat. In the fetid dark, she sat perfectly upright, was bounced up and down in her seat until she thought she might vomit. At last, the bus slowed. In the headlights' glare, she saw a set of gates manned by American MPs. One of the guards spoke to the driver, then backed away. The gates opened, and they drove through. Not much later, the bus stopped again.
"Here you go, ma'am."
Frankie was sweating so profusely she had to wipe her eyes. "Huh?"
"You get out here, ma'am."
"What? Oh."
She realized suddenly that she hadn't gone to baggage claim, hadn't retrieved her duffel.
"My bag."
"It will be delivered, ma'am."
Frankie gathered up her purse and travel bag and went to the door. A nurse stood in the mud, dressed in a white uniform, cap to shoes, waiting for her. How on earth could that uniform be kept clean? Behind her was the entrance to a huge hospital.
"You need to exit the bus, ma'am," the driver said.
"Oh, yes."
Frankie stepped down into the thick mud and started to salute. The nurse grabbed her wrist, stopped the salute. "Not here. Charlie loves to kill officers." She pointed to a waiting jeep.
"He'll take you to your temporary quarters. Report to admin for in-processing tomorrow at 0700.
Frankie had too many questions to pick just one, and her throat hurt. Clutching her travel bag and purse, she walked over to the jeep and climbed up into the back seat. The driver hit the gas so hard, Frankie was thrown back in her seat. A jagged metal spring poked her in the butt. The nighttime traffic on base was stop and go. In snatches of light, she saw barbed wire and sandbags built up around wooden buildings, armed guards standing on towers. Soldiers walking the streets in fatigues, holding guns. A large water tank truck pulled up next to them, rumbling, and rolled past. Horns honked constantly, and men shouted at one another. Another checkpoint. This one looked haphazardly thrown together with metal drums and coils of barbed wire and a tall chain-link fence. The guard waved them through. Finally, they came to another fence, this one topped in coils of concertina wire. The Jeep braked to a stop. The driver leaned over, shoved the door open.
"You're stopped, ma'am."
Frankie frowned. It took time to maneuver out of the Jeep in her tight skirt.
"In that building, ma'am. Second floor, 8A.
Behind the tall ironwork fence, she saw what looked like an abandoned prison. Windows were boarded up with plywood, and big chunks of the walls were missing. Before Frankie could ask where to go, the Jeep was backing up, honking at something, and speeding away. Frankie went to the gate, which creaked loudly upon opening, and stepped into a weedy front yard, where scrawny children played with a half-deflated ball. An old Vietnamese woman squatted by the side of the fence, tending to something cooking over an open fire. Frankie followed a broken path to the front door and entered the building. Inside, a few gas lanterns flickered light against the walls. There was a woman in fatigues waiting for her in the shadowy entry.
"Lieutenant McGrath?"
"Thank God."
"Yes. I'll show you to your room. Follow me."
The woman led the way past a hallway filled with cots and up a set of sagging stairs to a second-floor room. Cubicle, really. A room barely big enough to hold the set of bunk beds in it with a single dresser. Maybe the building had once been a convent or a school.
"In processing tomorrow at 0700 hours. Report to admin."
"But..." The soldier walked away, shut the door behind her. Darkness. Frankie felt around for a light switch, found, and flipped it. Nothing. She opened the door again, grateful for the bit of ambient light coming from gas lanterns in the hallway. She went in search of a bathroom, found one with a rust-stained sink and toilet. She turned on the faucet, got a weak flow of tepid water, and washed her face, then took a drink. A woman in an army green t-shirt and shorts walked in, saw Frankie, and frowned.
"You'll be sorry about that, Lieutenant. Never drink the water." "Oh, I'm new, in country."
"Yeah," the woman said, eyeing Frankie in her skirt uniform.
"No shit."
Frankie woke in the middle of the night with cramping in her stomach. She ran down the hall to the toilet and slammed the door shut behind her. She'd never had diarrhea like this in her life. It felt as if everything she'd eaten in the past month came rushing out of her, and when there was nothing left, the cramping went on. Dawn brought no relief from the pain. She checked the time, rolled into a ball, and went back to sleep. At 0630 hours, she got up, stood on shaky legs, barely able to button her uniform. The panty girdle was torture. Outside, the weedy yard was full of skinny-armed Vietnamese children who eyed her silently. A laundry line held dozens of green fatigues. She pushed past the gate and walked through the huge, busy base, which was a haphazard collection of buildings and tents and shacks and roads without a tree anywhere that she could see. They'd obviously created the place with bulldozers. There were pedicycles with whole families on them, old cars pulled by water buffalo, and dozens of army vehicles vying to get somewhere fast. A Jeep splashed past her, the driver honking at the children on the side of the road, at the water buffalo roaming alongside. No one looked twice at the woman in her Class A's, walking carefully, hoping not to vomit. It took Frankie nearly an hour to find the administration building, which was situated near Ward A of the sprawling Third Field Hospital, where nurses in starched white moved in groups, sometimes running, and announcements blared through black speakers. She knocked on the closed admin door, heard, "Come in," and did as she was told. Inside the office, she saluted to the thin female colonel seated at the desk in front of her. The woman looked up, lifted her chin in a sharp, bird-like motion that upset the perfect perch of her cat's-eye glasses. The way she sighed at Frankie's entrance was hardly encouraging.
"And you are?"
"Second Lieutenant Francis McGrath, Colonel."
The colonel rifled through the paperwork.
You're assigned to the 36th Evac Hospital. Follow me.
She rose sharply and walked past Frankie to the door. Frankie struggled to keep up, hoping she wasn't going to have another bout of diarrhea. The colonel led the way through the throng of personnel toward a round white helipad with a red cross painted on it, where a helicopter waited. The colonel gave a thumbs up to the pilot, who immediately started the engine. The huge rotors rotated slowly, became a blur that blasted hot air at her.
"I have questions, Colonel,"
Frankie stuttered.
"Not for me, Lieutenant. Go, he doesn't have all day."
The colonel forced Frankie to bend forward and pushed her toward the whirring helicopter. At the open side, a soldier grabbed her by the hand and swung her inside and then shoved her toward a canvas seat in the back of the aircraft.
"Hang on, ma'am,"
the soldier yelled as the helicopter immediately lifted into the air, dipped its nose, and then soared forward, flying over the huge American base and then above the chaos of Saigon. Frankie's stomach rebelled at the movement. This did not seem safe. And where were their guns? How could they shoot back at the enemy if necessary? She heard an explosion somewhere. It rattled the helicopter, which swooped sideways. She clamped a hand over her mouth and prayed that she wouldn't vomit. Another explosion. A rattle of gunfire. The helicopter shook hard, clattered like 1,000 bolts in a metal box. Frankie survived the terrifying flight one breath at a time. It was often all she could do not to scream. And then, miraculously, they were descending, lowering toward a helipad. When they touched down, the co-pilot looked back at Frankie.
"Ma'am?"
"What?"
Frankie yelled.
"You gotta get out."
"Oh, right."
She couldn't make herself move. The soldier who'd helped her aboard, a medic, yanked her out of her seat and hauled her toward the open door. A female first lieutenant in stained fatigues stood nearby, holding on to her canvas hat, staring up. The medic threw Frankie's bag out of the helicopter. It landed at the first lieutenant's feet.
"Ma'am,"
he said impatiently. "Jump, Frankie." In heels. She hit the ground hard enough to buckle her knees. She dropped her purse and bent quickly to pick it up. Taking a deep breath, ignoring the pain, she slowly straightened and started to salute.
"Lieutenant McGrath, reporting for duty."
"Not here," the first lieutenant said. "I like being alive. I'm Patty Perkins, surgical nurse."
She held on to Frankie for just a moment, steadying her, and then abruptly let go and started walking.
"Welcome to the 36th. We are a 400-bed evac hospital on the coast about 60 miles from Saigon. You are one of 9 female nurses on staff in addition to male nurses and medics. We keep this place running,"
the first lieutenant yelled back at her.
"It's considered one of the safer posts. The DMZ is up north, so fighting here is minimal. We provide care for the VSI, who are medevaced."
Frankie struggled to keep up.
"VSI? Very seriously injured. Here, you'll see everything from leprosy to amputations to rat bites to what's left of a soldier after a landmine. Most wounds require delayed primary closures, DPCs, which means we clear and debride wounds but don't close. That will be your biggest job. Most casualties are here 3 days or less. From here, the lucky ones go to the 3rd Field Hospital in Saigon for more specialized treatment. The unlucky ones go back to their units, and the really unlucky ones go home in a box. Keep up, Lieutenant."
The woman led the way past a series of Quonset huts.
"That's the ER, pre-op, the 2 ORs, post-op, the ICU, and neuro."
She kept going.
"That's the mess hall. Officers on the right side. Report to Major Goldstein and admin tomorrow at 0800. She's chief nurse."
She came to an abrupt halt in front of a row of identical wooden buildings whose lower halves were protected by stacked sandbags.
"This is your hooch. Showers and latrines are over there. Shower quickly. The flyboys like to hover over and watch."
Patty smiled, then offered 2 bottles of pills.
"Malaria and diarrhea. Take them religiously. Don't drink the water unless it's out of a Lister bag or jerry can. If you want, I'll show you."
Patty stopped mid-sentence, cocked her head, listening. A moment later, Frankie heard the sound of helicopters.
"Crap,"
Patty said.
incoming. I guess you're on your own, McGrath. Get settled in.
With an encouraging smile, she patted Frankie's shoulder and hurried away. Frankie heard the thud of dozens of booted feet running on the wooden ramps throughout the camp. Frankie felt abandoned.
"Buck up, McGrath," she said aloud.
Reaching for the door to her hooch, she stepped up the single step and entered a dark, musty, buggy room about 15 feet by 30 feet that was divided into three separate cubicle-like spaces, each with its own green canvas and metal cot, a makeshift bedside table, and a lamp. Olive-green netting hung in swoops over the ugly plywood walls. Above one cot, color photographs were tacked to the wall. A couple standing in front of a red horse barn, a man with close-cropped hair leaning against the hood of a Chevrolet truck, that same man standing between a little red-haired girl and a huge black horse. Above the other cot were posters of Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali and Martin Luther King Jr. The third cot, hers presumably, had nothing tacked onto the wall, but the plywood was full of tack holes and torn bits of paper from posters that had been put up and ripped down. Her duffel bag was on the floor. There was a small fridge in one corner, and someone had built a bookcase out of old slats and filled the shelves with worn paperbacks. It was stiflingly hot, and there was neither a fan nor a window. A layer of red dirt coated the floor. Closing the door behind her, she sat down on the narrow cot and opened her overnight bag. A brand new Polaroid camera lay on top of the carefully wrapped stack of framed photographs she'd brought from home. She reached for the top one, unwrapped it, held it on her lap. The picture had been taken at Disneyland. In it, Frankie and Finley stood in front of Sleeping Beauty Castle, holding hands. A split second before the camera lens clicked, Finley had grabbed the ticket booklet from Mom and ripped out the e-tickets, saying, "Me and Frankie are going straight to the rocket to the moon, and then to the submarine." And Mom had said quietly, "I hope they serve drinks at one of those kiosks, Connor." Frankie felt the sting of tears. There was no one here to see or to care, so she didn't bother dashing them away. She stared at the image of her brother with his protruding teeth and spit-shined hair and freckled face and thought, "What have I done?" Next, she unwrapped a picture of her parents, taken at one of their famous 4th of July parties, both of them smiling, a table draped in patriotic bunting behind them. They had been right. She had no business being so far away from home, at war, without Finley. How would she last a year? At that, her stomach roiled again. She ran for the latrines.